loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by Brian Becker. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we go in depth with Max Blumenthal about the purge of real accounts from Facebook and Twitter. And then we take a look at political races around the country in the run-up to midterm elections in November. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Cesar Sayoc was arrested in Florida today in connection with more than a dozen pipe bombs that have been mailed to prominent critics of Donald Trump. Two more bombs were intercepted today after being mailed to Democratic Senator Cory Booker and former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. California Senator Kamala Harris may also have received a bomb today. Next, Representative Mark Meadows, a Republican from North Carolina, said following a seven-hour-long closed-door session with former Trump campaign advisor George Papadopoulos that the FBI's Russia investigation was on weak footing from the beginning and that the investigation of Papadopoulos in and of itself was unconstitutional. Papadopoulos told Fox and Friends this morning that the FBI had violated his constitutional rights and that he was considering withdrawing from his plea deal, even though he has already cooperated with the Mueller team and served 2 weeks in jail. Then, 16 years ago today, the U.S. anti-war movement burst onto the scene with a massive protest in Washington, D.C. The focus of the protest was to stop George W. Bush and Dick Cheney from taking the country to war in Iraq. Within a few weeks, that movement became a global anti-war movement, drawing in more than 10 million people. The New York Times in February 2003 called this unprecedented movement the world's second superpower. Today, I'm going to interview my co-host Brian Becker, the national director of the Answer Coalition, the group that initiated these mass protests 16 years ago today. And then an oil spill that has been quietly leaking millions of barrels into the Gulf of Mexico has gone unplugged for so long that it now verges on becoming one of the worst offshore disasters in American history. Between 300 and 700 barrels of oil per day have been leaking from a site off the coast of Louisiana for the past 14 years, since an offshore oil platform sank during Hurricane Ivan. It has never been capped. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst, funniest, and most misleading headlines. And in other headlines, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen said yesterday about the troops headed to the border, quote, "We do not have any intention right now to shoot at people. They will be apprehended, however. But I also take my officer and agents, their own personal safety, extraordinarily seriously. They do have the ability, of course, to defend themselves," unquote. Tomorrow, Turkish President Erdogan, German Chancellor Merkel, French President Macron, and Russian President Putin will meet in Istanbul to discuss the Syrian war. Erdogan said today that the agreements between he and Putin regarding the demilitarized zone had been fulfilled. He also threatened that he'd be focusing Turkish attention on the Kurdish forces east of the Euphrates River and west of Manbij. During the course of another Friday Palestinian demonstration against Israeli occupation, the Israeli Defense Forces have killed at least five Palestinians and wounded another 170. Since the regular Friday protests began on March 30th, the IDF has killed at least 210 Palestinians and injured more than 18,000 with live rounds, rubber bullets, and tear gas. Matthew Shepard was interred today at the Washington National Cathedral. Shepard was a young, openly gay man who was pistol-whipped, tied to a fence, and left for dead on Tuesday, October 6, 1998, in Laramie, Wyoming. He became an international symbol after his death for the trials that members of the LGBTQ community face. He's one of about 220 Americans buried in the National Cathedral. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the purge of social media. This month, Facebook and Twitter deleted the accounts of hundreds of users, including many alternative media sites. Many of those purged were popular sites that scrutinized police brutality and U.S. interventionism, like Free Thought Project and CopBlock, amongst others. Max Blumenthal has written a major article exposing the neoconservative cadres. They are former government officials and now affiliated with DC think tanks, who are playing a dominant role with social media organizations like Facebook in the new censorship of alternative media. We are joined from Washington, D.C. by Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist. He is a best-selling author whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project, the co-host of the podcast moderate rebels, and he is a filmmaker who, along with Dan Cohen, made the recent documentary Killing Gaza. Max Blumenthal, welcome back.
Great to be back.
In your Gray Zone Project article, which we were just reading in preparation for this segment, an amazing article, which everyone needs to take the time to read, authored by Max Blumenthal. The title of it is Facebook Censorship of Alternative Media, quote, just the beginning, close quote, says top neocon insider. Max Blumenthal, we've clearly entered an era where social media pages on Facebook and Twitter and alternative media therein are being purged. This is just the beginning, according to this top neocon insider who's part of the process, part of the purging. Let's get started with understanding who this person was that you're talking about and why this is, quote, just the beginning from their point of view.
Well, I think a lot of your listeners will be familiar with the fact that some 800 websites and users were purged by Facebook on the grounds of coordinated spam and, you know, inauthentic behavior. The reality is that many of these sites were legitimate alternative news sites that had focused on American state violence, particularly when it comes to police brutality and war abroad. These include the Free Thought Project, Anti-Media, and Cop Block, as well as users like Rachel Blevins, who had set up her own kind of Facebook news page where she did video logs and things like that. And she had amassed 70,000 followers. And all of their hard work was pretty much wiped out because they were relying on Facebook as their main platform for disseminating their views to the public and kind of going around the mainstream media. And Twitter wiped out a lot of these accounts in coordinated fashion. So there was coordination and nobody got a real explanation. And everyone was wondering, you know, how did this happen? I've been following the kind of campaign around manufacturing this hype about Russian bots and Russian influence accounts on Twitter and Facebook and other social media platforms. And so when this story came to me, it didn't really surprise me that much, as remarkable as it is. Jeb Sprague, who is a visiting faculty member in sociology at the UC Santa Barbara, and who's a friend of mine, went to a conference on Asian security in Berlin that was organized by Stiftung Wissenschaft und Politik, which is a, you know, basically a think tank in Germany. And there were lots of academics at the conference who were, you know, very well-connected insiders. Probably the most well-connected insider was Jamie Fly, who's Marco Rubio's former foreign policy advisor, was the director for a time of the Foreign Policy Institute, which is basically a reboot of the Project for a New American Century, Bill Kristol's kind of neocon cabal that made the case for war, an invasion of Iraq, and a series of regime change wars. And Jeb Sprague, who co-authored this piece with me, had a conversation with Jamie Fly in the hallway, where Jamie Fly essentially took a degree of credit for wiping out all of these websites and for putting the pressure on Facebook to take down alternative media. He basically said that, you know, he claimed that they were sort of fake news. They invent stories. And he said, now we're just starting to push back. Just this last week, Facebook began starting to take down sites. So this is just the beginning. And he complained that Facebook and Twitter had been too accessible to members of the public. Now, I knew Jamie Fly because he was I wasn't surprised by his comments here, because Jamie Fly is a leader of the Alliance for Securing Democracy, which is this new group born out of the German Marshall Fund, which is funded through the State Department and other Western governments in Washington, which focuses on the threat of supposed Russian bots and calls for basically pulling the plug on anything that can be remotely connected to Russian-backed media. They have this fake dashboard called Hamilton 68, which claims to track Russian bot activity, except they don't say who the bots are, which is really convenient. And recently, one of the researchers behind this dashboard, Clint Watts, admitted that real people, they're actually tracking real people who may not even be Russian. So basically, they're just tracking people who have dissident opinions that don't dovetail with the NATO narrative. So it didn't really surprise me that this group behind the scenes which is funded by Western states and is basically a civil society front for Western governments, is putting the squeeze on Facebook to take down a lot of alternative sites that have that feature dissident views. And we got this kind of on the record at the security conference, thanks to my co-author, Jeb Sprague, who was willing to publish these stunning comments by Jamie Fly.
Max Blumenthal is our guest. Max is a journalist. He is a best-selling author. He is a filmmaker. We're talking to him about his article about the purge on social media, Facebook and Twitter, and how this phenomena has unraveled, or, well, that's the wrong way to put it, has gathered steam over the past 2 years, starting with the ignominious and unexpected defeat, Max, of Hillary Clinton. In your article, you talk about sort of the, well, at least in some small way, the genesis of how this thing has evolved into a full-scale witch hunt, not just of Russia and things Russian, but alternative media. It started with Hillary Clinton's inability to take responsibility for the defeat, the unexpected defeat against the most unpopular political candidate in American history, Donald J. Trump. Just talk about how this, in fact, did get started.
Yeah, I mean, we have to follow the progression, I think, from the sort of birth of the Russiagate narrative to the present to see how the fear of Russian disinformation and interference was weaponized and instrumentalized by Washington insiders in order to gain public consent for their real goal, which is suppressing dissident views that they blame for complicating their political ambitions. The insider's account of Hillary Clinton's political presidential campaign, it's a book called Shattered, revealed that just in the days after her election, she was unable to take responsibility for her loss, Hillary Clinton. So her advisors, Robbie Mook and, the communications director, Jennifer Palmieri, basically engineered the case that the election wasn't legitimate and that Russian hacking was the centerpiece of their argument. So just like 3 weeks after Clinton was defeated, I started noticing this Washington Post article being shared by former members of her team and her inner circle and former Obama insiders, basically saying, you know, we finally exposed how, you know, the Russians have defeated our candidate. And it was by Craig Timberg, who is a, you know, published a series of dubiously sourced stories about Russian propaganda. The headline was Russian propaganda effort helped spread fake news. And it was promoting this McCarthyite effort called Proper Not, which had introduced a list of some 200 American alternative media outlets and called them Russian online propaganda. But many, I mean, there RT was on there, Sputnik was on there. Okay, it's Russian state-backed media. You can kind of get away with saying that. But so Truthdig was on there as well, a site created by Bob Scheer that I write for. Black Commentator was on there. Counterpunch was on the list, as well as Anti-Media, the Free Thought Project, and so many of the sites that were recently taken down. Now, Proper Not was kind of laughed at because it was anonymous. It seemed like a kind of crank thing to do to produce this McCarthyite blacklist and call these sites Russian. It got criticized even in the New Yorker.
But it was pushed by the Washington Post, was it not?
But it was pushed by the Washington Post, which then proceeded to amend the article with a kind of editor's note saying, we can't vouch for the credibility here. Then Proper Not kind of went away. But that list, obviously, the concept behind it flourished. And then a few months later, well, I would say 8 months later, this initiative that I mentioned earlier, the Alliance for Securing Democracy and the Hamilton 68 dashboard on Russian bots suddenly emerges. And this time, I mean, this group is not anonymous. It's operating under the umbrella of one of the most reputable think tanks in Washington, the German Marshall Fund, which, as I mentioned, is funded by the U.S. government and other Western governments. And they had an advisory board, which is basically a who's who of neocons and liberal interventionists, including Bill Kristol, the founder of the Project for a New American Century. Jamie Fly, the neocon insider, is a staff member alongside Laura Rosenberger, who was an advisor to Hillary Clinton's campaign. So it has this bipartisan veneer. And they're running around with this dashboard claiming that the Russians are pushing certain issues into the American discourse in order to sow discord. And you can go on Twitter and find all kinds of people who are, you know, sort of centrist types pushing the bot narrative and turning to the Hamilton 68 dashboard and their various graphs to say, oh, the NFL take a knee protests. Well, the Russians are pushing that hard today to divide us along racial lines. And as I said before, They never name which bot accounts they follow, and they've admitted recently that the bots may not even be Russian and are real people. But the idea is that the Russians are dividing us. We have to do something. They basically manufactured the scare, which is the shock. And then the doctrine is mass suppression of alternative media. Now we see that happening with these takedowns of websites. Last year, I should also mention that a number of Palestinian news sites were taken offline under some pressure from the Israeli government. So this isn't just hitting American alternative media. But the point is that this all emanates from Russiagate and the narrative around Russiagate, and it created space and public consent for the mass removal of completely legitimate American independent alternative websites. And we've seen almost no outrage about this except from those same alternative media circles of which I'm a part.
We're talking with Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist, award-winning, best-selling author and filmmaker. Jamie Fly, who you mentioned before, and I want to get back to something you mentioned just now, Max, about the truly bipartisan Republican and Democrats. I would say the two parties of the American ruling class. So in some ways, they're always bipartisan on some issues, certainly the military budget being one of them. Maintaining 1,000 military bases overseas being another. But we could go forward and take that to a number of other issues which are considered, I would say, vital to the empire. But I want to emphasize this for our listeners, because people think of themselves as Democrats, or possibly fewer of them listening to this show think of themselves as Republicans. But we have this war against alternative media. Its origin is in the so-called Russiagate, sort of, I don't know, let's call it a witch hunt. The genesis of that begins with the defeat of Hillary Clinton, but then it takes on its own life and dovetails with, coincides with other agendas, especially the agendas of the intelligence community and the military-industrial complex. And then you go back to this personality, Jamie Fly. Max Blumenthal points out in the article, like other neocons, he first burrowed in as a mid-tier, second-tier official in the George W. Bush administration, becomes an influential foreign policy hardliner, Max says in the article, who has spent the last year lobbying for the censorship of quote unquote fringe views on social media. But over the years, he's advocated for a military assault on Iran, regime change on Syria, and hiking military spending to unprecedented levels. He's the embodiment of a neoconservative cadre. Those are the words of Max Blumenthal. And Max, it's really truly the case that these neocon cadres are members and leaders of both parties. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the whole bipartisan alliance for securing democracy really represents a cast of characters who have expected continuity from administration to administration on foreign policy, and that foreign policy be rooted in the values of American exceptionalism and based on the ideals of a Pax Americana or American empire. And they were extremely freaked out, to put it lightly, about the election of Donald Trump, who had campaigned on a kind of non-interventionist line and really hammered the Bush family. So you see a lot of former Bush advisors involved with the people who, the other side that lost to Donald Trump, the Hillary Clinton advisors. Now they kind of have that continuity again, but their campaign on Russian interference in the Russiagate narrative lives on. So basically the point that I am, that I find most alarming about this article is that these are not just sort of civil society watchdogs who care about better media and who care about pushing fake news out of our timelines. These are people with an agenda. These are people who've pushed fake news consistently throughout their entire careers, whether it's fake news that Iran had an active nuclear weapons program, fake news that Iraq was involved with al-Qaeda and was creating WMD, or fake news that Gaddafi's troops were marching on Benghazi to commit the worst slaughter of our time unless we intervened. These are people who've used fake news, and it's cost literally millions of lives. These are very dangerous people. They are connected to Western governments, and they're basically running a front organization to give a civil society patina to what is a Western government campaign of suppression. And we also know that the Atlantic Council, which is funded by NATO, as well as our good friends in Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Turkey, and the arms industry. The most military, one of the most militaristic think tanks in Washington, is in a partnership with Facebook to clean up its platform of supposed fake news. And the Jamie Fly confirmed to my co-author, Jeb Sprague, that he's working with the Atlantic Council to do this. So these are the people that are now in charge of the private social media platforms that represent our digital commons. And we're not really talking about state suppression. We're not talking about censorship by Western governments and their most extreme elements. What we're talking about still are these social media platforms trying to purge themselves of fake news. And so we need to reorient the narrative and understand what's happening here, because it is a scandal and we don't know who's going to be next. But I assume that me and you guys are definitely on the target board.
This is the dirty little secret of Washington. Max has talked about this a couple of times on the show. And to tell you the truth, I get a ton of responses. You probably do too, Brian, of people telling me that they had no idea that think tanks wield such power and such authority in Washington. They had no idea until Max told them. Well, this is another component of that. You've got now neocon right-wing extremist with ties to Marco Rubio and others on Capitol Hill, who is actually making the calls about what kind of news you and I get to read.
And what Max is saying, and I think it's so important, is that this really is the government, but it's shielded or masked or camouflaged through the entity of think tanks that appear to be civil society organizations, when in fact, maybe formally, yes, but not really. When you look at their funding and not when you look at their cadres.
And most people don't talk about funding.
Yeah. And Max, I want to go back to one other element of this story, which I think is really important to bring out. I'm looking at The Guardian from 2011, 7 years ago. Talk about the government. The headline is "Revealed: U.S. Spy Operations That Manipulate Social Media." Subtitle: "Military Sock Puppet Software Creates Fake Online Identities to Spread Pro-American Propaganda." And then it goes on, the U.S. military is developing software that will let it secretly manipulate social media sites by using fake online personas to influence internet conversations and spread pro-American propaganda. And then the story goes on about how the U.S. 7 years ago developed this capability. But I would bet if we talk to the American people right now, did a survey, who's responsible for this kind of conduct, this kind of manipulation? Even though this is, I would say, in many ways, a manufactured sort of conviction through the media, people would say, no, this is Russia. But in fact, this was a cyber offensive operation by the U.S. government and some of the same personalities in the Atlantic Council and in these think tanks. They're the same people. But at that time, they may have been government cadre, not think tank cadre. Go ahead.
Well, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the people behind this who are, you know, doing the nuts and bolts research and creating these kind of crank dashboards are actually people who've run influence operations themselves, whether within the military or within some other realm of the national security architecture. These are people who actually are carrying out one of the greatest disinformation campaigns of our time, which is Russiagate. And it goes on. I mean, we just learned about Twitter purging thousands of supposed Russian accounts. And, you know, in the press release that by the Atlantic Council, which I mentioned before, which is funded by NATO, the Atlantic Council said Twitter gave us an exclusive preview. So they're working with Twitter as well, influencing, you know, Twitter's platform. And basically, the findings came to nothing, that most of these supposed Russian bots were publishing in Russian. So they weren't even influencing the American public. Most of their tweets didn't reach the U.S., and the Atlantic Council's researchers actually found they had no effect whatsoever. But if you read about them in the New York Times or the Washington Post, it was kind of like Pearl Harbor all over again. And we constantly hear these bombshells, but they really have very little perceptible impact on the American public. And again, it's about creating public consent for a much more far-reaching goal, which is replicating and expanding U.S. power in order to repress all dissident narratives and countervailing forces to it. The perfect example of how this was rolled out was through Alex Jones, who's someone we all have contempt for, see as a right-wing carnival barker, a conspiracist. He was completely removed from every social media platform, down to Pinterest, without being found guilty of violating any of the terms of use. And the kind of liberal left Twitter sphere I saw really celebrating this thing openly. And to me, that was a green light because Alex Jones was a trial balloon for a wider purge that would take place. And so it was a green light for these forces to start deepening their purge, which they proceeded to do 2 weeks later by purging these 800 sites and users. And there will be more, as Jamie Fly promised. So I think, you know, the propaganda is that these sites and users actually pose a threat to our democratic discourse. And then beyond that, the more invidious propaganda is that they're Russian or somehow involved with Russia. I think obviously the ultimate goal is to completely pull the plug on RT and Sputnik. And that includes, you know, getting Sputnik off the radio airwaves, but they're just building towards that. And but by building towards that, they have to build public consent by seeing how far they can get. And that requires a lot of propaganda of their own.
This may have been a trial balloon.
One trial balloon followed by another trial balloon. Mm-hmm. But each one, to the extent, this is why it's important we're doing this story and why Max is writing these articles.
Oh, yeah.
It's important because to the extent that the government is testing and to the extent that the government gets away with the test about purging, you know, first silencing an ultra-right nut job like Alex Jones and have everybody say, oh, good, because he was a right-wing nut job. Then the government can say, okay, that worked. Now let's get rid of the people they call left-wing nut jobs. And as soon as that bandwagon is jumped upon, they have leeway. They have sort of the green light has been given. There's no, you know, sort of, and if the government had done it, if the government had done it explicitly, if it wasn't a private corporation like Facebook, you'd have an actionable case. You'd have a First Amendment case. But as long as it's social media working with the government or with government cadres vis-a-vis these think tanks, and it's the private corporations shutting down and being the censoring entity, then that private action against the government on, based on free speech violation goes away. So then it really is just a test of public will. And the public will on our side will only be strong if it's well informed. That's why, Max, I think what you're doing in the article is so important, because we have to expose this and try to lift the fog, lift the curtain that's dropped over some people's eyes, people who should know better, to understand what's at stake. What's at stake really is the exercise of genuine, authentic free speech in America. That's really what's at stake. And I'm not being hyperbolic. Go ahead.
I was just watching an old recorded episode of Oprah, where Oprah hosted this really, I thought, useful and robust debate on rap music lyrics, because there was this campaign in the 1990s run by Tipper Gore, who was the wife of Al Gore, who was kind of a right-wing Democrat constantly running for president and losing in the Democratic primary, and William Bennett, who is this right-wing Christian moral monger. And so they had this bipartisan campaign to censor rap lyrics and to kind of punish rap artists. And Oprah hosted a debate. It also, on the other side, was Jello Biafra of the Dead Kennedys and Ice-T, whose lyrics were under attack and whose career was kind of in the sight lines of Tipper Gore and William Bennett and the kind of Christian conservative movement. And the audience got really involved in this debate. And you could tell that the American public was not comfortable, even though they might not have been happy about some of the things Ice-T was saying. They were not comfortable with censorship and they considered it an un-American value. This debate was taking place in the public, but there is no debate taking place over censorship on Facebook, which really represents our digital commons. And now we have two think tanks that are funded by Western governments and by authoritarian repressive governments like Saudi Arabia that have been put in charge of these digital commons. And what we see, and we're witnessing in real time, a campaign of state-sponsored repression of dissident and alternative views, and there's no debate about it, no public debate. So the first thing we need to do is get a public debate going and start understanding this for what it is, which is state-sponsored repression.
Yeah, and there's no other way short of a public debate that this can be turned around. Anyway, I want to encourage our listeners to go to grayzoneproject.com. Max Blumenthal's article is entitled Facebook censorship of alternative media, quote, just the beginning, close quote, says top neocon insider. We were joined from Washington, D.C. by Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist, best-selling author. His latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and the co-host of the podcast, Moderate Rebels. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. It's Friday, so again, we will take a look at races around the country in the run-up to midterm elections in November. We're joined from Washington by Jackie Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out her live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Welcome back, Jackie.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
Jackie, we're 11 days out from this election, and things are really tightening up. I wanted to start off by saying that I spoke again with a top Trump campaign official, national campaign official, who told me that Republican Party internal polls are showing that the Republicans will pick up two Senate seats, that is Missouri and North Dakota. They will hold all of the other seats that are being contested. And they believe that the Democrats will not win the House of Representatives. They think it's going to be close, but by a margin of between 2 and 8 seats, they believe the Republicans will hold the House of Representatives. What do you think of those numbers?
Really? That's interesting. I agree with the Senate. I agree with their predictions on the Senate. But I'm interested on what they're basing their belief of not losing the House are on.
Well, they think that I can answer that. They think that Donald Trump has so riled up his base recently, whether it's these bombs, you know, being a Democratic false flag that the Russians are mailing the bombs or Bernie Sanders is mailing the bombs and just this really harsh anti-media rhetoric. It's getting people energized on the right and the far right and motivating them to get to the polls. They may even be the ones voting early. Remember, you and I talked last week about early voting and the Republican numbers are up by something like 150% nationwide. So they think that they're peaking at the right time and that the Democrats are not.
And you know, I don't know that that's going to be the outcome, that they will win the House because of that. But here's what's horrifying to me about that prediction, that they're okay with that, that there is this vitriolic, hateful, and let's be honest, this is hate. This is not political frustration. No, this is a president who is continuing and ramping up a very long history of the GOP's quiet little subversive dog whistles that he's just taken to a bullhorn. And you're seeing this play out in races in some states that should be just clear decisions for people with conscience. But then you have to kind of come to the realization that, no, more people in this country really don't have morals in the real sense. I'm not talking about in the traditional political conservative sense. I mean, actual human decency that we'd like to be comfortable with. Now, I don't know that that's going to translate to the Republicans winning the House. But I do agree that this sentiment that Trump has managed to whip up openly and brazenly among his base has caused some races to be closed that really should not be if we were a decent society.
Right. Well, you know, I think he's right about the Senate. I think that Heidi Heitkamp is toast. I think that that Claire McCaskill has been very lucky for a very long time and her luck may be running out. And I think the Republicans are wrong about Arizona. I think the Democrats are going to pick up a seat in Arizona. But I still believe that the Republicans are going to end the day on Election Day still in control of the Senate. I agree with you on the House. I think damage has been done. I think that a lot of California Republican congressmen are going to be swept out. I think with redistricting, court-mandated redistricting in Pennsylvania, as many as 5 Republicans could be swept out there. I think that a lot of races in North Carolina are competitive. either because of redistricting or planned redistricting. I think it's energized Democrats there. So I think, sure, it's going to be close, but I think the Democrats are actually going to take the House. You know, one of the things that we've not really talked about, well, we touched on it last week, but we haven't really talked about it in depth, and that is gubernatorial races. Jackie, there's one, when I read this article, it was in the Argus Leader from Argus, South Dakota. I don't normally read that paper, but I stumbled on this fantastic article. There's a guy running for governor in South Dakota. His name is Billy Sutton. Not Bill, not William, it's Billy. Billy Sutton. He is a professional bronco buster.
No, come on.
Seriously, he's a professional rodeo rider and bronco buster.
Not that I have anything against that. I think that's great.
It's pretty great, right?
Yes.
He's running against the Republican, Kristi Noem. Now, Kristi Noem is a popular candidate. She's a Republican in a very, very heavily Republican state. The governor there, Dennis Daugaard, is term limited, so he's not running. But this race, believe it or not, is tied 50-50. Or really, it's 45-45. Now, why in the world would that be? 9% are undecided, 1% are planning to vote for the Libertarian. This is a poll conducted by the Mason-Dixon Polling and Strategy Company in Jacksonville, Florida. They're well-known and usually relatively reliable. I think that some people might argue that they're more of a Democratic poll than a Republican one. I would disagree with that. But it says here, the numbers illustrate that for the first time in more than 40 years, a Democrat could be poised to take the governor's mansion. While campaigns' internal polls reported a tightening race, and the Cook Political Report earlier this month shifted the race from likely Republican to toss-up, this is the first independent poll to show the race is a dead heat. And in the days ahead of the contest, both Noem and Sutton campaigns appear keenly aware of the tight nature of the race. I'm amazed by it. I got to tell you, too, they have pictures of both of them. And this Billy Sutton is hilarious. He's wearing a cowboy hat that is so big that his head is swimming in it.
That's what's helping him. That's what's pushing him.
I'm not going to ask you about this race, Jackie. I wouldn't expect you to know anything about it. I didn't know anything about it. I don't think anybody knows much about it. But I just wanted to say that this is one of those crazy years that there could be these upsets that we're just not prepared for, you know, that we just don't. Nobody's talking about the South Dakota gubernatorial race. And just to give you an idea that these numbers are for real. It says here, support for the candidates tends to break along party lines. 82% of Democrats say they'll support Sutton. 71% of Republicans say they'll support Noem. That's kind of normal. Independents are 57% with Sutton, 32% with Noem. 1% are undecided. So, you know, this really is a dead heat.
I really do think this is interesting. As a reflection of how voters are seeing politics in general, just the fact that I think this is an extension of that pushback on quote unquote establishment politicians, because this guy is a bronco buster. I mean, that's a great thing. I'm not at all making fun of the fact that he's a bronco buster, but he's a bronco buster running for governor, and he could win. That you don't get much more outsider than that. I really just don't think you do.
I have to agree. There was another really crazy thing that happened this week. Crazy because I can't remember anything like this happening in my lifetime. So it took place in Alaska. And Alaska is one of those crazy states that elects independents all the time. So the governor of Alaska is Bill Walker. Bill Walker is an independent. He's running against a Democrat, former Senator Mark Begich, and he's running against a Republican. Now, the lieutenant governor is a guy named Byron Mallott. Byron Mallott made an inappropriate comment to a woman 2 weeks ago and was forced to resign. So that sort of set off a chain reaction of events that just could change everything. Well, you would think that because Bill Walker used to be a Republican, he's now the independent governor, that he would endorse the Republican, Mike Dunleavy, a former state senator.
But he did not.
He endorsed the Democrat, Mark Begich.
And then,
And recent polling then shows that Walker and Begich were each hovering around 25%. Dunleavy was ahead with 40%. It looked like Dunleavy was going to actually win this thing. Walker quit, endorsed Begich, but Walker's name is still going to be on the ballot because the ballots have already been printed.
Right.
The reason why the governor is doing this is because the lieutenant governor was his best friend. They actually ran against each other 4 years ago, and they realized that they were just like so into each other that that Malott, the lieutenant governor, dropped out of the race and then quit the Democratic Party and joined Walker as lieutenant governor as an independent. Now, does that make clear sense?
I saw this story, John, and I could not figure out, I couldn't figure out why Walker did this, because I thought, okay, I understand this is Alaska, and Alaska is really, they're a very independent-minded people, and that's great. You never know what's going to happen in Alaska. But that was such a big surprise that Walker just dropped out through his support behind Begich. And now Begich is probably gonna win this race just by enough.
I think he is.
Fascinating.
It is. It's fascinating. Begich is well known in Alaska because he was the U.S. senator there. He only lasted one term. He was defeated for re-election, which surprised no one, because frankly, his election in the first place was kind of a fluke. But with there being no independent in the race, and there's always an independent in the race up there in Alaska, and the former governor, or now soon to be former governor, throwing his support behind the Democrat. Yeah, the Democrats could actually win this thing.
Yeah, the governor's races, I think, are they're under the radar a little bit in national coverage. And that's there are a couple of other governor's races that are really, really important, that at least one that we should be paying more attention to, that could mean a lot as far as voting rights are concerned.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. I want to go back to Nevada, Jackie. We talk about Nevada almost every week. But now that we're getting so close, as I said, we're 11 days out from the election, we have to take a closer look at Senator Dean Heller. Dean Heller is maintaining a very narrow lead against Democratic Representative Jackie Rosen. Jackie Rosen is a very popular congresswoman, and she represents Las Vegas. Well, that's where everybody lives. They all live in Las Vegas. And certainly they vote in Las Vegas, and the unions support her, and the unions run Las Vegas. But she's just not a very good campaigner. So the Democrats are starting to panic. Barack Obama went out there this week to campaign for Rosen at a rally. Joe Biden went out a couple days earlier to do a rally for her at the local culinary union. And she's still behind in the polls. So the Republicans are actually confident that Heller's going to pull this thing out. It might be 50-50 or 51-49, but they believe that he's going to keep this race. And in fact, a Republican Party official said the blue wave is being shattered, and it's going to be shattered in Nevada. What do you think of that?
I mean, Nevada is one of those races, I think, that if the Democrats actually had more of a message and a platform other than just not Trump, they would have walked away with this, because especially since since Rosen is so popular. But the Democrats don't have that kind of an inspirational message. And coupled with being a bad campaigner, that's spelled doom for her. And I think it may indeed be too late.
I think you're probably right. There are two other issues here. First of all, Dean Heller has never lost a race. He won three statewide races for Secretary of State, and then he went to Congress, and he never lost a congressional race, and then he ran for Senate, and he won that. The second thing is, he has a very well-crafted negative ad, and it's very simple. The tagline is, keep California out of Nevada. And the reason he says that is because Jackie Rosen has raised an inordinate amount of money in California. She's actually outraised him cycle after cycle after cycle, every single quarter. For example, in the third quarter, she raised $7 million. He raised $2.2 million. In the first half of October, she raised $5 million. He raised $1.8 million. So she's clobbering him in fundraising. But a lot of that money's coming from California. And Nevadans hate being pushed around by California. And they see themselves as constantly being pushed around.
Mm-hmm. And without recognizing that as the sentiment among the voters, coupled with bad campaigning and a weak Democratic message, that I think Rosen is done.
I think so, too. I think the Republicans are going to keep that seat. Before I let you go on to something else, I wanted to read a statement from Mike Slanker. He's a longtime strategist for Heller, and he said it very simply. He said, Heller is always misunderestimated. Just kidding. He says, Heller is often underestimated, but he's a proven winner. He won three campaigns for Secretary of State before leaving for the House, and he ultimately won his first Senate race in 2012, even as Obama carried Nevada by more than 6 points. Dean Heller connects with people. He just does, and he always has. There's a reason why he's won every election he's always run for. It's because people like him. And I think that's the bottom line. He's a nice guy. People like him.
Yeah. I think that's gonna carry him through again.
I think so, too. There's a very odd House race, Jackie, in Texas. This is a guy named Chip Roy. Chip Roy was a top staff member for Ted Cruz, and he was the architect. He was the idea man behind Ted Cruz's strategy back in 2013 to shut down the government. And, you know, that was wildly unpopular around the country, but it was actually pretty popular in Texas. Politico says that Chip Roy is so conservative that he makes Ted Cruz look like a squishy moderate.
Oh, my God.
A squishy moderate. It says here, Roy is ready to play hardball with GOP leaders in Congress. And I can tell you, that is not going to endear him to anybody in a position of authority. He has already pledged to support House Freedom Caucus founding chairman Jim Jordan for speaker and is expected to quickly establish himself as one of the House GOP's most outspoken, combative, and conservative members. He's going to win, because he's running in a district that has never been won by a Democrat. Is this part of a trend, or is this a one-off? Is he going to end up looking like a nut, or is he going to be successful in leading a resurgence of the Tea Party, which has really just kind of fallen by the wayside?
Well, I think both can be true. I think he is going to end up looking like a nut. I mean, Ted Cruz doesn't look any less like a nut than he always did, and neither does the current president. But they're still popular, especially when you're looking at Ted Cruz's, the latest poll for Cruz, he's up 6 points in Texas in some places. So this man being more conservative than Cruz is not what people are really focusing on. I think they're supporting him because he is combative, because he is saying that he's willing to challenge the Republican authority in Washington. That's what Republican voters now want. They expect this combativeness from their anti-establishment Republican politicians now. Mm-hmm. So, I do think this is kind of a trend that, yes, the Tea Party started, but like I said, I think this ties right back to Trump and his ramping up of this kind of bare knuckles, that down in the gutter kind of rhetoric.
You know, he says, too, that he is actually a part of a movement. He's calling this year the third Tea Party movement. And he says here, it began when Mike Lee was elected instead of Bob Bennett. That was in Utah. Ted Cruz instead of David Dewhurst in Texas. Rand Paul instead of Trey Grayson in Kentucky. Marco Rubio instead of Charlie Crist in Florida. Those were tectonic shifts in the party, and we saw the rise of the Freedom Caucus. Now you've got a block of people in Washington saying, I'm going to represent the people and the conservative values that the people sent me here to represent. And that's at odds with the power brokers who want to maintain control at all costs. That does not sound like a guy who's trying to impress McCarthy or whatever other mainstream conservative is going to end up as the Republican leader in the House of Representatives.
Exactly. He is there to push back against the authority because the people he represent have no respect for the authority that's there. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I just believe that the ends to their means are dangerous for all of them. I think we should all have a healthy mistrust of most of the authority. But why you're doing it and what you plan to get out of it and what you plan to do with that challenge to authority in regard to other people, especially people who are marginalized and not like you, that's the question. And this guy and the people that he is representing, that they don't have the same kind of vision for that challenge to authority that we do. And that's dangerous.
You just mentioned likability. I want to talk about likability for a minute. Let's move over to Florida, to the Senate race there. We've got, of course, the incumbent Governor Rick Scott running against Democratic Senator Bill Nelson. This is the most expensive Senate race in the history of the Republic. They're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. It's an outrage. But anyway, that's thanks to Citizens United. That's the system that we have. Anyway, the reason this is newsworthy is we have three consecutive polls now released after Nelson got wall-to-wall positive media coverage for the way he managed the response to Hurricane Michael, okay? Literally nothing went wrong on his end in the aftermath of Hurricane Michael, which just obliterated the panhandle. Despite the fact that he came out of that smelling like a rose, three consecutive polls have him losing to Nelson by 6 percentage points. He's furious about this. And it says here his campaign excoriated Quinnipiac University's survey on Monday, showing Nelson with that same large lead of 6 points. It says the governor argues that he is in fact leading by 5 points, that he, Scott, is leading by 5 points, which is nonsense because these are all polls that are independent of one another. Now, we talked about the governor's race last week. We talked about Gillum and DeSantis running against each other. It looks like Gillum's going to win that race. Well, is this Gillum coattails? Is this anti-Trump? Is it anti-Scott? I mean, the guy's been popular so far. And remember, he's got very deep pockets. He's a billionaire and he can finance his own races. Why is he losing by 6 percentage points?
I think his track record on climate change really is what kind of sunk him, especially after this horrible hurricane. I mean, policy positions do have consequences with people who actually pay attention to them. And as lackluster as Nelson has been, and as great a response to the hurricane that Scott has had, it's still true that people who live in the area and who were impacted by the hurricane have said on multiple occasions in multiple outlets, well, Governor, your views on climate change have come to bite you because look at what has happened now that we haven't been prepared because you didn't think climate change was real.
And, you know, they've got this red tide and green tide and algae blooms and millions of fish are washing up dead and seals are dying and state employees are forbidden by law from speaking the words climate change.
I mean, unfortunately, it took a hurricane, and I don't want people to misunderstand what I'm saying, but it took a hurricane for Rick Scott to get why his views on climate change and his legislation relating to climate change and whether it could be talked about or not was actually harmful.
I think that's right. But people aren't really talking about that. They're talking about everything else. They're talking about Donald Trump. They're talking about the money that's being spent in this race. And they're not talking about climate change. I think that you are onto something. Now, I actually went through the Florida papers, the major papers, Tampa, St. Pete, Miami, and they're not talking about climate change. That's an utter mystery to me. I just simply don't understand it. But with that said, I think that the people of Florida are indeed concerned about climate change.
Yes, the media is still, and this is, because let's not forget that a lot of local media outlets, not just television and cable, but also print outlets are still owned by 6 or 7 major corporations, and they have basically a gag order on talking about climate change. So the voters know this, the voters see it, they live it, and they are reflecting that in these polls, and I think it's going to be reflected in 11 days at the election.
I want to go over some of the latest polls in the last 3 minutes or so that we have. There are some surprises. But a lot of these results are, they serve to confirm what this Republican campaign strategist with whom I spoke told me. Let's see, Texas Senate race, Cruz beating O'Rourke by 6. We've been saying that for weeks. I like Beto O'Rourke a lot, but I think he's going to lose that race.
It's mystifying to me, but yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, getting to these House races, we've got California's 10th district. This is Denham versus Harder. Harder's the Democrat. Democrat is leading by 2. That's one of those really close races. Illinois, 13th District, Davis versus Londrigan. Davis, the Republican, up by 5. That's one of those toss-up races. There's another toss-up race, New Jersey's 3rd. This is MacArthur versus Kim. Republican MacArthur up by 1, 45 to 44. We've got a big race in Ohio's 1st District, Chabot versus Perival. Chabot, the Republican, up by 9. Texas's 7th District, Culberson versus Fletcher. Culberson, the Republican, up by 1, 46 to 45. Get back to the Senate. We've got Nelson over Scott by 1, Nelson over Scott by 6. Michigan Senate, Stabenow over James. Stabenow, the Democrat, up by 7. In California, Dianne Feinstein up by 16 over De Leon. They're both Democrats. Florida governor. This one, this is WCTV, which is a local station in Florida, has DeSantis, the Republican, beating Gillum by 3, 48 to 45. Georgia governor, which is one of the most closely watched races in the country, has the Republican Kemp beating the Democrat Abrams by 2, 49 to 47. Remember, that magic number is 50.
Yeah, and that's the race that could end in a runoff because of the independent. I think he's a libertarian.
He's a libertarian.
Yeah, the people don't even know is there.
No.
People have no idea he's even running.
No.
And this race could signal, if Kemp wins, this says a lot to me about voters in this country who are supporting this Republican Party and their willingness to support voter suppression and the lack of morality people have. And it also would spell certain doom for voting rights, just the continued expansion of voter suppression in this country, because Kemp is actually being sued right now.
Yes.
For suppressing votes in Georgia. And the fact that he's predicted to win this race is horrifying in terms of a so-called democracy in this country.
It sure is interesting. We've got only like 15 seconds left, so I'm going to say the president's job approval disapproved by 11, by 4, by 6. Congressional job approval disapproved by 47 percentage points, 72 to 25. Generic Democrat versus Republican, we have the Democrats up by 7, Democrats up by 8, Democrats up by 8. So it's going to be close. We don't know if it's going to be a wave. We just have to wait and see. In any event, we're out of time. We were joined from Washington by Jackie Lukman. Jackie is the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 o'clock on Facebook. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.